This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world. Place to Be Nation, welcome to the epicenter of Southern wrestling, JT Allen. This is Letters from Center Stage Theater.
As the biggest night in the history of this great organization.
You are gonna feel the bad!
Nation, welcome to episode number 3 of Letters from Center Stage. I am JT, of course, here in our offices in Atlanta, Georgia, our satellite offices of PlaceToBeNation.com, and we're about to dive deep into the outer rim of nostalgia mothership that was WCW. But before I take off on that voyage, of course, I need to pick up my co-host here on the show, and that is the chap they call Alan. Alan, how are you, sir?
I am, as always, phenomenal, JT. Really excited for another Letters from Center Stage, getting to the deeper outer rim that was the mothership, as you said. So we've got a good couple of questions on the show, and shall we start by delving into the yet-to-be-named still, SAC?
Hi, I'm Missy Hyatt, and welcome to Missy Does the Mail. This week's letter comes from Nikki Davis of Long Beach, California, who wants to know what I think of the new U.S. heavyweight champion.
Well, we're calling it a sack, but whatever.
Plunder? I thought we were going with Plunder Bucket. We're not going to go with that?
Maybe Plunder Bucket. So let's just reach inside that Plunder Bucket and get the first one. So the first one today is a question for Letters from Center Stage. What's your opinion on the Goldberg-Regal match from Nitro in 1998? And that's from Lawrence Miles on Twitter. So thanks for the question there, Lawrence. Mm-hmm. So the whole Regal-Goldberg, was it a shoot? Wasn't it a shoot? That happened in February 98. We both watched the match now, haven't we, JT? What's your kind of takeaway thoughts from it?
Well, in my mind, it was always like pretty bad. Like, I thought Regal really fucked him up and made Goldberg look stupid. But rewatching it, I didn't think so. Like, I know Regal has said in the past that he was just told to make, you know, make him look good or whatever. And basically, you know, Regal took that as, let me go out there and wrestle with him, show that he can wrestle. And you can see that Regal is trying to work some holds and turn it into a match. And Goldberg is just, like, having none of it because he doesn't know what the hell he's, you know, supposed to do. Like, there are times where, you know, Regal's trying to work a hold and Goldberg just pushes him away. And, you know, at one point, Goldberg knocks him down and just kind of stands there. And, like, you know, they don't know what they're doing. Or Goldberg doesn't know what he's doing and how to mesh with Regal. And it seems like Regal's just trying to work hold after hold. And then I thought the finish was actually really good. Like, I thought he really crushed Regal with the spear and then the jackhammer. There was an awful diving shoulder block by Goldberg in there, and there was a weird spot where he went to whip Regal, and Regal kind of just stopped and turned around and whacked him back, and it was pretty stiff. You know, the announcers didn't really pick up much on it. They were just kind of calling the match and talking about other stuff like WCW announcers always did. But if I saw this, I wouldn't have thought that he was trying to screw with Goldberg at all. I just would have thought they just weren't really on the same page. Goldberg was a little green still, a little bit lost. I definitely wouldn't have looked at this at the time and felt like, wow, you know, Regal was really out there trying to make him look dumb. I mean, in my mind, it got to that point later because I kept hearing about it. But rewatching it, it didn't feel that way to me.
No, it didn't feel like that way to me either. I just think this is the definition of a clunky, clumsy match between two guys that just weren't suited stylistically to work against each other. And that's what it boils down to. I mean, William Regal talks about this in length in his book, and he basically goes out and says it wasn't a shoot. The office just wanted Goldberg to show a more technical side alongside Regal. But obviously Goldberg just wasn't seasoned enough. He was still green as grass at this point. I mean, Dave Meltzer in The Observer, whoever was there live, sent in the report and they gave it minus one star, the actual match itself. I wouldn't say it was that bad. I would just say it was a clunky TV match, maybe half a star. You know, it was not as bad as people make out. I think there's been this kind of last 20 years, this kind of mystery story about it. There's this hard-hitting, you know, match. I mean, if you're talking shoot matches, you'd think that, you know, a match between Finlay and Regal would come across more as a shoot than something like this. This was this was just clunky.
Well, and if you're Regal and you're going to shoot on a guy like Goldberg, you're not going to stand there and like bully him. You're going to try and get him on the ground and then just like hook him in like a front face lock or something like that, you know, and really ride him to the mat and hold him there. You're not gonna go toe to toe and smack him around and try and work holds with him on, you know, standing up. Maybe if the Sandy was trying to embarrass him, but God, Goldberg would just wreck him if he was. So I can't imagine a guy like Regal. I mean, unless he was, you know, under the influence going into the match, which I guess is entirely possible in this time frame. I can't imagine that he's stupid enough to go out there and try and go toe to toe with Goldberg in a shoot. I would think if it was, he would have had him on the mat and trying to tie him up in holds. And the match really didn't go that way.
No, not at all. I mean, Meltzer has commented on this. I went back into the archives and looked at the Observer from February 98. And all he says really is, Bill Goldberg pinned Steven Regal with a jackhammer at 5:01. Simply put, it doesn't matter the opponent. Goldberg's matches have to be 90 seconds. He was totally exposed here, and everyone in the crowd was before the crowd's eyes. There was some heat on Regal because they thought he was kind of exposing him, since Regal is a legitimate shooter as opposed to a paper shooter. But Regal was just doing a wrestling match, and Goldberg only has three spots in his quick burst of intensity. And it's lost doing anything else. So, you know, that's all it was, and that was the initial thoughts. And then Regal comes on E-Yarder a few years later, the old E-Yarder Wrestling Observer shows in the late 90s, early noughties. And on the episode of that, Regal said that one of the agents actually booked him for a 7-minute match versus Goldberg. And Regal said that... along the way that Goldberg forgot what he was doing, and Regal had to do what he did because I can't hit myself. So I think that the agent that he was alluding to was Terry Taylor, mm-hmm. In that one. So this is maybe a catalyst for Regal going the final nail in the head, but I wouldn't say this was the reason for why he was given, you know, his pink slip, so to speak, because the contracts weren't renewed. When the rollover period expired, that's all that happened. It was him, Bobby Walker, and Dave Taylor all at the same time this happened to. And obviously, we do know that they came back again, a lot of these guys. So it's just one of those things. It's just WCW for you, a bit of mismanagement. Left hand doesn't know what the right hand's doing. But it did expose someone who was potentially, you know, a main star. And we did touch on this, I think it was it episode 2, last episode, with the Raven match?
Right.
That had been episode 1. That's when he really heated up, and this was a couple of months before that. I mean, as we know, it didn't hurt him long term, so to get rid of Regal as a reason for this, I think that's a little bit harsh.
And I thought it made him look tougher and then just mowing him down, because he actually survived a guy throwing some bombs at him for once, and he went toe to toe. And even though he looked a little bit lost, I mean, if you were just looking at it from an outsider point of view, where you're not really, you know, knowing that they're working together, if you're just looking at it as a fight, I think it made Goldberg look tougher. Like, he had to fend off a pretty game Regal here, who looked to be on top of his, you know, on top of his game at this point. So I thought, you know, I don't think it hurt him at all. No, I don't think so. I mean, everyone knew what he could be. One 5-minute match buried in a 3-hour TV program is not going to end this guy's run, no matter how much everyone likes to blow things out of proportion. But I would think the issue with Regal, you know, maybe this was in their minds when his contract came up. It was kind of like, well, you know, we know he's probably a drug addict at this point. We know he's been around forever. We have a million guys on a contract. Do we really need William Regal at this point? And he may or may not have just screwed with our biggest star. So, you know, assumed to be biggest star. So those things may have all come up when they were making the decision. Or, like you said, they just forgot that his contract was up, which is equally as possible. But I would think all the other stuff, you know, coming together and then mixing in with this, maybe it was like a 1% of the reason. Like, it was in the back of their minds that, hey, this could have been that. I don't think it was, though. I mean, Regal's a guy who's never really lied or had a reason to lie.
No, he's a stand-up type of guy, really. So, yeah, I think I agree with you. I think the other thing he mentioned was he was yelled at nonstop from Eric Bischoff as soon as he came back through the curtain. But the actual agent, Terry Taylor, who told him to go out and work this style of match, just stood there with his face buried in some papers, trying to, you know, avoid anything happening to him. So it was a bit of a bad showing there from Terry Taylor, if that actually happened, which I've got no reason to doubt from Regal. Like you said, he's never really come across as someone that's lied. What reason has he got to?
And Taylor's always kind of had the reputation of being a little wormy when as an agent. Like, he never really is someone that seems to have much conviction in what he does or says. So it wouldn't shock me at all if you know, Taylor. And maybe Taylor had issues with him. I mean, Taylor might have sandbagged him. I mean, he's home to go out there doing that, knowing that, you know, people get pissed. It was totally within the realm of possibility in the backstages of WCW that he fed him misinformation on purpose just to make him look dumb.
Oh, yeah, definitely. So I think that hopefully answers the question there for you, Lawrence. We didn't think it was bad as, you know, some people did. We didn't think it was a shoot. We just thought it was a clunky match, and it didn't really lead to his firing per se, but it may have been a smaller reason for it. So shall we now go on to the second question in the plunder bucket there, JT?
Yeah, let's do it.
Right, so Dave Allen and JT, I remember in the early 90s, a Battle of the Underdogs tournament on some WCW shows. All I remember was Scotty Flamingo and a young RVD as Robbie V as participants. Did I imagine this? Did this end up going anywhere? Love the show, glad to have you back, guys. And that's from a big-time supporter and friend of the show, Joe Spotstow. So thank you very much for the question there, Joe. So this WCW Battle of the Underdogs tournament, bit of a kind of under-the-radar thing. It was something I may have heard about before, but I didn't really pay much attention to, and it's not something I remembered at the time. Going back to your memories of WCW, is this something that you ever recalled before?
I have very, very vague memories of it. And I feel like it's mainly because of Rob Van Dam as Robbie V. Like, I remember they had a Robbie V match on his old WWE DVD that came out back in the mid-2000s. And I don't know if it was this one or not, but I want to say the old WWE Classics online service, not the 24/7, but the one that was online on WWE.com only, They did a thing where they showed a bunch of like tournaments, and I know I mentioned this for the arm wrestling tournament, and I feel like some of these matches were on there as well because I vaguely remembered seeing them like not that long ago. And I thought, yeah, I guess we could talk about it now, but I thought Robbie V, I thought he looked great. I thought it was kind of cool seeing him as a high energy babyface, like not doing his usual mellow "I'm too cool for school" shtick. I thought he had good presence, and when you're watching that match with Pat Rose, it is clear that like Robbie V is not just a jobber, like that he's a guy working his way up. Versus a guy like Pat Rose who looked like he'd be there forever in that role if he were to stick around. So I thought he really stood out. And if you look at this list of guys, he's clearly the guy that would stand out anyway on the list. Yeah, Joey Maggs. So I'll read through the results here and then I'll get your thoughts. November 7th, Joey Maggs fought Bob Cook. 11/14, Ian Weston battled John Peterson. 12/5, George South, of course, a pretty well-known name, battled Ricky Nelson. On 12/26, Keith Cole. Poor Keith Cole, battled Mustafa Saeed, and on 123, so a month later, they threw out one more of these matches, Robbie V versus Pat Rose. I guess clearly a Bill Watts idea, and not a bad idea to showcase some of these guys, and why not add some intrigue to low card matches, and maybe you find something, like a guy like a Robbie V, make him stand out among the rest of these guys. And this is before the Cole twins were a thing. That was like 93, wasn't it, when they were a team?
Yeah, the Cole twins in 93 when they were doing autograph signings, as we discussed, JT, for fans of the house show that the ring truck didn't appear at.
Yes, the big heroes of the day there.
Yeah, I think there's good points and bad points about this because I had a bit of thought about this. So Bill Watts, it's a Bill Watts idea. It was basically the job guys could face each other in competitive matches, which makes sense on paper. But as a fan, I'm flicking the channels. I turn over and see two massive geeks like right. Ian Weston and John Peterson on my TV in a competitive match. I think, hang on, these guys aren't stars. What the hell's going on? This isn't, this isn't what I want to watch. And, they turn the channel and a negative perception of WCW there in a way. It may have been explained that in a better way, that this was for up-and-comers and this, that, and the other. I don't know how it was portrayed on TV, because the only kind of footage we found was the 12/26 match. Was the Keith Cole, Mustafa Saeed, who went on to be one of the gangsters with New Jack. That was a match where the Heavenly Bodies, which was the first incarnation of the Heavenly Bodies, when WCW were doing a kind of a deal with Smoky Mountain. So you had Stan Lane, and you had Dr. Tom Pritchard as the Heavenly Bodies, and you also had Bobby Eaton with them as well. So people thought there was a Midnight Express with Dr. Tom, but no, it was actually the Heavenly Bodies, the first incarnation. So there was an angle going there between Smoky Mountain and WCW that we may touch on in a future episode. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, then we had Robbie V, who some people may have heard the 605 podcast, where people actually thought Robbie V's name was Robbie Five. Yeah, the V was a five because they taught him wrestling.
Think,
yeah.
Did they think they were trying to like capitalize on Rocky Five, having just come out with Robbie Five?
Yeah, no, definitely. So yeah, I think from research as well, JT, the Robbie V Pat Rose match was the one that was on the Classics on Demand, not the Classics on Demand, on the Rob Van Dam DVD that came out about 10 or so years ago. So yeah, I mean, the only match and footage we saw was about a minute of Keith Cole and Mustafa Saeed, and then, like I said, they got attacked by the Heavenly Bodies and Jim Cornette. So we didn't really see an outcome to that match. The sound isn't great on it. It'll be in the actual YouTube playlist, but there's not really much of a takeaway from that. So unfortunately, there was no other footage here, so I wasn't sure how this was put across on TV.
Robbie and Pat Rose is out there. I watched it.
Yesterday. Oh, did you found that?
Yeah, and it's pretty good quality. So it looked like it was from, I believe it was from WWE. So I don't know if they pulled it off the DVD and threw it up on the YouTube or if it was online at some point, but that match is out there. And like I said, he looked pretty good at it. Like he definitely came across as more of a star in the match than Pat Rose. And it was funny seeing that energy. But, you know, I get your point. If you're flipping around, you're probably, you know, looking at these two guys and kind of like a... But I guess that my question is how many people were actually flipping around, stumbling into WCW at this point? I would think in late 92, I think their fan base was their fan base. But I don't mind the idea. I don't know if I would have done it on Saturday night is my only question, because that was really their main program at this point. Maybe like a power hour or something in the morning, you know, where you're not really... competing, you know, we're not putting out your biggest, heaviest storylines and matches. So maybe it would have been better suited for a B or C show worldwide or main event or something like that, and not on Saturday night. But I kind of liked it. I mean, it's, you know, we see Ring of Honor do it these days too with the Top Prospect tournament every year, and you know, it's a thing. So I don't think it's the worst idea in the world. Now, could you have maybe peppered in, you know, someone a little bit better than Joey Maggs? But I guess at the time in '92, wasn't Joey Maggs kind of still maybe like a fringy prospect? He wasn't like a complete job boy at this point, was he?
Well, yes and no. Joey Maggs, jumping Joey Maggs. He had springs for legs, like many wrestlers of this era. Great, dark, fantastic curly mullet as well. Oh, yeah. No problem with Joey Maggs, a good TV wrestler. But yes, going back to the original point you said about Saturday night being the mothership, the main show of WCW, this was a different world to the syndicated shows. They had different storylines, different things to that. So this wouldn't have spilled over anywhere else. This was its own universe. But I think being on the 605 show on a Saturday night on TBS, I don't know if this was best suited for that, when they could have had guys that they're actually going to push. Because out of all this, let's look at all the guys again. So we had Joey Maggs, okay. Bob Cook, Ian Weston, John Peterson, George South, Ricky Nelson, Keith Cole, Mustafa Saeed, Robbie V and Pat Rose. Who actually did anything really?
Robbie V and not there, Mustafa Saeed and not there, and it wasn't because of this, and I guess Keith Cole. You could argue Keith Cole is the most successful in the world of WCW of this group, which is kind of sad. I mean, RVD obviously never wrestled there, unless you believe that he was headed there in 2001 before they closed. I guess, you know, if you're looking from pure WCW kayfabe point of view, I would say it goes Keith Cole, Joey Maggs, George South, and then the rest, I guess. I mean, if you're talking about who actually benefited from this in the world of WCW.
Yeah, I think the most famous person there is probably George South. He's probably had the most TV time out of any of them over the years, because he's gone back till the mid-80s in Crockett. Mm-hmm. He was around. He was doing some kind of Starcade stuff as well, or he may have been on one of the Jim Crockett Senior Memorial Cups, the tag tournaments. But he's been featured a little bit higher on there. But really, the underdogs, it screams Battle of the Underdogs, so it's Battle of the Geeks. I mean,
I don't get the end game. Was it, I mean... Maybe because Watts gets fired, because he gets fired in what, February-ish, right?
Yeah.
Is it around
that?
Okay. Yeah. So, I mean, maybe they had a plan in place that we don't get to see. Because I'm really curious what was meant to come of this. Because if you look at it, the only thing that ever happened was really that Heavenly Bodies thing. And that had nothing to do with the tournament. That was just getting their thing over. So it's like, what, you know, what was the point? Who was this meant to build up? Because even Robbie gets, like, he doesn't dominate Pat Rose, and it's not even like a tournament. So you're just kind of having these matches. Are you just filling time? Is this something different? Like, I just don't get what the end game of it all was. Like, there's no, they're not crowning anyone like the champion of the Battle of the Underdogs. There's no progression. You know, it spans 3 months with five matches that just kind of are there.
Well, what they should have done, Battle of the Underdogs. So all these matches are on TV. I mean, it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Doing some sort of round robin or something right. That's got a purpose. And the winner gets a TV title shot because they've wrestled 3 or 4 times on TV and got wins.
Mm-hmm.
So they are a good TV wrestler in that kind of argument to a degree. Obviously, the opponents are lesser. But give it a reason, give it a point. And to be fair, it may have been given that reason early on. It was explained on the commentary. I don't know. But it didn't come across to me in any of the research that I found.
So who was champion, I'm trying to look up real quick, in February of 93, I wanted to see if, okay, so Paul Orndorff, it was vacated from Scott Steiner. Paul Orndorff won it in a tournament that ended March 2nd. So you're telling me you couldn't have had, you know, a little mini Ron Robin and have Orndorff's first defense be against, like you said, the winner of the Ron Robin? And why not get behind a Robbie V? He had a good look. He was young. He was, you know, pretty exciting in this one, you know, couple matches we saw. Why not give him a big match on The Clash or Saturday Night, like you said, with Paul Orndorff, and maybe he sneaks out the win, maybe steals a win or something like that, and then you're off and running with him. It seems like a missed opportunity on what obviously ended up being a pretty big name, and I don't know if he progresses the same way without the ECW mentality that he was able to build, you know, his character around, but at least you're keeping a guy who had a really high talent level and seemed to connect with the fans in-house for a title that was doing nothing between October and March, and then eventually on Paul Orndorff, who would hold it for like 4 or 5 months, and again, pretty forgettable TV title reign for him in 93.
No, yeah, definitely. I mean, he had the feud with Cactus Jack, I think it was at Super Bowl that year. That was quite a good match, but apart from that, none which stood out to me about Paul Orndorff's run as a TV champion. The other thing they could have done as well is, whoever wins this round robin could have just gone into the tournament.
Right, that's
it. You know, as a shot in the tournament, but that requires long-term planning and booking, which really we don't see much with WCW in certain areas, this being one of them. So, yeah, it was what it was. It was some guys. It's a footnote in history. I mean, we're not really going to talk about any of these guys again in a kind of WCW
well, the
speak.
Coles,
so.
The Coles are kind of becoming our unofficial mascots here.
Oh, yes, just saying that. Yeah, I do like the Coles. I mean, the one memory of me of the Coles is they had Sting's haircut.
Yes.
I mean, they had the bleach blonde flat top haircut. That's the only thing, and they were both tall guys, and I don't know if they came from Florida or somewhere like that. I don't know, but
I think so.
Yeah,
that was usually the place.
Yeah, they were green as grass, and yeah, they were twins, and that was basically all they had going for them. So yeah, that was hopefully that answers the question there for, as I said, friend of the show, Joe. So thank you very much for the question, and any more questions you've got, send them our way.
For
so
sure.
should I jump into my car?
Yeah, but I just wanted to note real quick that, because it astounds me, that tournament final for the TV title aired on Power Hour, which is weird, because I feel like they didn't always have big matches on Power Hour. This whole time frame is... You know, I want to explore more as we move along. But yes, you know what? It is time for Alan to jump in the car, because it is time for our WCW Road Report, looking back at this week in WCW history.
The United Center, but tomorrow night we're going to be at the Wisconsin Center in Milwaukee. We've already sent our good friend Lee Marshall there, and he reports in from Milwaukee on the road with 1-800-COLLECT. Lee, are you cold?
Tony, I am cold, but the only thing keeping me warm here is the cheeseheads. I mean, the fans here haven't been this excited since the Bucks won the coin toss and got Lou Alcindor as their first pick.
Well, this week in WCW history, it's a bit of a sad one, really, is what happened on this day. So this show comes out on Friday, which is going to be Star Wars Day, May the 4th. So on May the 4th, 1994...
Actually, it'll be May the 5th. It'll be Cinco de Mayo, Alan.
Well, no, I'm wrong. Yeah, May the 4th tomorrow. Yeah, I'm wrong. Yeah, it's May the 5th, Cinco de Mayo. So happy Cinco de Mayo Day to everybody who celebrates it. So Rick Rude defeated Sting to win the WCW International World Heavyweight Championship, which is... another muddy affair, the international title. But it would actually turn out to be Rude's final match, as he severely injured his neck during the bout. Rude eventually would be stripped of the championship on a technicality, and he would remain out of the wrestling business, really, for the next 3 years when he showed up in ECW. So, I mean, it's a bit sad, really. I mean, Rick Rude, he'd fantastic wrestler. Really, really great, fun, American-style pro wrestler. Great on the mic, great look. Great in the ring, great bumper. The guy had it all, really. And it was such a shame that, you know, his career ended, you know, unceremoniously like this.
Yeah, that match was in Japan in front of 53,000 fans. It was a part of a big joint card. And, yeah, Rude, that was a 22-minute match. And the match was actually pretty solid. But you can see when his back goes out. Like, you see it during the match, and he is hurting. And it was sad because he was really, really hot during this run. He had tapered off just a little bit toward the end of 93 when he had that stuff with Flair, which, you know, had good matches, but I think suffered from, like, super high expectations where people thought they'd be classics. Instead, they're just really, really good. And he seemed primed for a face run that would maybe put him over the top. Like, he had this great, great couple years as a heel, and they were starting to do this thing with him and Vader kind of going at it. And it seemed like it was time that they were going to turn him and just push him hard into the top of the card. And whether that was a feud with Flair, or maybe they keep him heel and have him go with Hogan. You know, it was one of Hogan's, you know, earliest opponents too. But there was definitely potential there for Rude in 94. He had been one of the best. And it's funny because his run in WWF was so, so good, mainly due to his character work. And then he gets to WCW and turns up the dial in-ring and just puts on fantastic match after match. And, you know, was a centerpiece of the Dangerous Alliance. And it was sad to see him go out like this in a match that not many people outside of Japan saw at the time. You know, they kind of strung it along, hoping maybe he'd still make it back. I think it's at Slamboree, right, where Vader fills in for him and loses. Does he lose the title to Sting? Yeah, he does. It was actually considered vacant because they said that Rude obviously had to forfeit it. So, you know, it was supposed to be... I'm trying to read through this. So do you remember the whole details of it? Was it Rude, supposed to be Rude versus Vader, and then Rude had to back out? I thought Vader stuck. Graham has it as Rude was subbed out for Sting, but I thought it was the other way around. I thought Vader was defending the title on behalf of Rude. Was that a different show?
No, I think, I mean, getting back, I think it was a different show. But getting back to the injury itself, it was on the New Japan show. It was the one where I've tweeted this gif out before, and I'll do it again on the show. It's a nasty injury, and it's described here in the research that it was his neck, and I was also under the impression it was his back, because he hits his lower back. It's like an elevated ring, so Sting does a dive outside. Rude catches him, and his back lands squarely on the corner of this elevated ring, and it's nasty, and it's just careless from New Japan, just kind of a unsafe working environment like that. And they haven't learned, because this is something that they've still got this elevated ring. And I've forgotten who it was, but someone nearly got nastily injured. I think, I don't know if it was late last year or early this year, but it was, I don't know if it was Tangaloa or it was someone anyway, and it looked nasty. So it's not good that, you know, they have this elevated ring. I do appreciate from a live audience perspective, to have an elevated ring is going to mean there's going to be better sight views for them. And in turn, potentially better heat on the match, but for the expense of someone's health and well-being, I don't think it's worth it. So it's a shame that he went out in 94. But getting back to Rude, as kind of my memories of him, I think, did his powers go, JT, when his moustache, he actually shaved his own moustache off? And should he have done a hair versus moustache match with someone as the kind of payoff rather than just shaving it off himself?
Yeah, I do agree. It seemed when he shaved the moustache, things took a little bit of a hit. It doesn't look the same. I know the era was kind of fading of the moustache at that point, but I agree that he should have kept it or at least made it count. He had it for so long just to shave it for no reason. At least get it shaved, even if it's not a stip. You know, have someone attack him and shave it off as punishment. But I agree. I mean, that mustache is up there with some of the greatest mustaches in, I'd say, wrestling and pop culture history. I mean, I know, obviously, Magnum P.I. is, like, the big one, and even Magnum T.A., I guess. Where does Rude rank for you on the all-time mustaches? It's pretty high.
Oh, he's definitely up there in the all-time moustache list. I'm thinking of other guys with moustaches. There's like was Manny Fernandez. He had quite a good moustache. We obviously had the Fu Man. We had the Hogan kind of moustache, the handlebar one. But Rude was definitely up there. The only man in current pro wrestling who's got a real man's moustache who can grow one is Silas Young from Ring of Honor. I think he's got a great-looking moustache, and I think he looked weird without it. But that's kind of the only guy in the modern era who I like who's got
Doesn't,
a good moustache.
Does Joey Ryan have one? Does he have a moustache?
Yeah, Joey Ryan, but I don't care about Joey Ryan. Joey Ryan's got one as well, and it kind of is retro look, isn't it, right, that he's going for there. He's doing that ironically. I think Silas Young likes the moustache, and that's why I like him. Any man, I mean, I don't have a moustache. I've got a beard, but being the stereotypical wrestling fan that I am, of course I've got to have some sort of facial hair. But I mean, one day I might just see what I look like with just a moustache, just for the crack.
You're gonna look creepy. I've tried it. I did it for a Halloween costume one year, and it looked awful. I hated it. So looking back through here, it looks like the confrontation I'm thinking of happened at Spring Stampede, where Rude had lost his title previously to Sting, and he blamed Vader. They got into an argument during the interview, and then Rude regained it from Sting, and then that happened where it gets vacated. They said it's because of the way Rude defeated Sting in Japan. They were stripping him of the title and putting it on the line, but then Rude was hurt and he couldn't compete, so we had Sting versus Vader at the main event of Slammery 94, and Sting regains the title. In that match, the vacated title.
But yeah, my favorite Rick Rude WCW match was probably the Beach Brawl Beach Brawl 92. It was the Iron Man match against Ricky Steamboat. They had a really good feud in 92 as well, but that's kind of the standout match for me. But there's plenty of good Rude WCW footage. I mean, he debuted at Halloween Havoc in 91. It was the most obvious person.
he was the
Masked Phantom or the Halloween Phantom, and he finishes... God, it's escaped me who he's wrestling now. Might be one of the Armstrongs or something like that, but he beat him with a Rude Awakening, so it was kind of an obvious reveal there. And the same in ECW, when he showed up in ECW, it was obviously Rick Rude under a mask with a nice sweater on as well. So yeah, they don't disguise him very well. He's got kind of one of those lean physiques. It's kind of hard, not to think it's him.
He defeated the Z-Man at that show.
Oh, Z-Man, Tom Zenk, how can I forget? Great value guest on E-Yarder back in the day, Tom Zenk, and then he kind of disappeared off the face of the planet.
I think he got threatened for his life, and then he just vanished. That's my guess. I think Vince had someone show up at his door one day and kick it down and threaten him, and he just walked.
Oh yeah, and he did some great Jim Barnett impressions as well, from memory as well, from his time dealing with Jim Barnett, which is probably something for another show.
Zink was ahead of his time. If he would have hung on a little bit longer, he probably could have made a lot of bank with all the shoot interviews and podcasts and everything else. He was like one of the first ones out there doing that kind of stuff on a mainstream basis, like you said, on those shows. And he was a pioneer for many later on that would when the shoot thing really, really picked up.
Oh, yeah, definitely. But I think he would have been seen now as a Billy Jack Haynes type Probably. Rather than a Jim Cornette type on shoot interviews. So, yeah, that's Rick Rude on this day or on this week in history. So that was his swan song. His final match ever, he won. Not many wrestlers can say that. Obviously, it wasn't planned to be his final match, but that's what happened, unfortunately. So, yeah, that was that one. So shall we now get to the highlight of the show, which is the long-form question?
Let's do it.
Okay, so let me dig deep and find the long-form question. So, dear Alan and JT, I vaguely remember WCW wrestlers being on Baywatch in the 90s. Can you tell me a little bit more about this? And that's from Mental Mike in London. So thank you very much for the question there, Mental Mike. Hopefully we don't make you more mental by listening to the show and you enjoy it. But wow, this is a loaded questionnaire, isn't it? I mean, what did you guys think? And tell me a little bit more about this. So, WCW teaming up with the kind of Baywatch TV show, which was really successful and big in the 90s. We both watched this, and this is going to be on the playlist, the full episode. As well as if you don't want to watch the full episode, there's some individual clips on there as well as some random Hulk Hogan music video that is a site as well, with Hogan running down the beach with some kids following him. It's all sorts of amazing. So, yeah, you watched all of this, most of it anyway. I think I caught about 15 minutes of the actual show itself. So what was your kind of major takeaways from it, JT?
That the acting on Baywatch was terrible. but it was it's funny because I the more I watched the episode now, the more it came back to me as I was, you know, watching along that, oh, God, I remember this now. Like, it was all flooding back in my memory banks. I liked the tie-in. Like, I will say that. I thought it was a good use of would have been Bash of the Beach 95. Obviously, they filmed a bunch of it there. And then this aired in early 96, so that, you know, it didn't come out right away, right after it. But I think it was actually well done. Like, I thought it was smart for them to take the opportunity. They're out on the beach. Baywatch was pretty big at this point. Why not go ahead and do a pairing? I mean, Pamela Anderson was red hot. And which I thought was really funny is Pam Anderson, how entwined with wrestling she was in 1995. She was at the Royal Rumble, at WrestleMania, and then at Bash at the Beach. Probably one of the rare, like, big celebrity years in wrestling for Pam Anderson there.
But, well, that's a good point, actually, yeah.
Right? It's weird. And I was thinking that as I'm watching. I'm like, wait a minute. This was, like, a couple months after Mania, so it's funny how involved she was in wrestling. And still didn't look like she gave a shit about any of it. But Hogan is awful here. I mean, awful. Like, if you needed more proof of what a bad actor Hulk Hogan was, like, this would be it, because there are guys that don't act, quote unquote, that are running circles around him. Like, so he comes in, he's just talking like he's in a bad porn movie when he's talking up the babe on the jet ski. He's like, oh, he's like grunting at her like a fucking nut, and then Savage cuts him off on the jet ski, and Hogan, you know, he's still staring at the babe, and then he hits a big wave and the jet ski crashes on top of him. So he gets dragged to shore, and you know, a couple of the lifeguards come over, and they're giving him CPR, and they save his life. And this made me laugh right out of the gate. Hogan gets saved. This had to be at least 10 minutes, right? By the time they get out there, they pull Hogan to the shore. Everyone gathers around. They save his life. Maybe 6, 7, whatever. After Hogan is recovered and sitting up, Savage pulls up. Like, what the fuck was he doing that whole time? Was he just cruising around on the jet ski? He obviously saw the incident go down. He saw the commotion on the beach, and he pulls up like 6 or 7 minutes later. It wasn't that long of a ride on the jet ski. They swam out and saved Hogan quicker than that. That was the first thing that was like, what the hell was he doing out there? He's just like watching everything
go down.
Well,
I'll tell you what he was doing. He was lamenting about his failed marriage with Miss Elizabeth that Hulk Hogan ruined, allegedly, in 92. So he's trying to get one back on Hogan. I'm not saving Hogan's life, brother. I'm going to let him die. So luckily, Pamela Anderson and many other hot chicks in swimsuits all rushed around and saved his life. And Hogan comes to life and... Yeah, wow. That's the first kind of major scene of the show, isn't it? So that's about 15 minutes of it is that.
And then him and Savage start bickering on the beach, right? And Savage is like, oh, I don't know, brother. This isn't the last time, you know, first time you've been looking at babes and leaving me hanging. Like, he's all fucking mad at him for checking out the babe. And then Hogan gives him shit about cutting him off and cause, you know, about his wild driving out on the ocean. It was so weird. Like, these guys are always constantly bickering. But it was such a weird, like, Savage has no concern that this guy was sick or injured. He just comes and gets right in his face about ignoring him for the women. Such an odd, just an odd opening turn for two guys that are kind of like best friends throughout this episode.
Did you notice the weird little vibe between Pamela Anderson and Hulk Hogan in this show?
I can't wait for them to bang or something. I mean, like, they're, yeah, they obviously were playing up the sexual tension between the two. A couple of times they're talking, and they're, like, really, really close, like, face-to-face when they're talking. I was waiting for them to at least kiss.
Oh, yeah, there was a point when Hogan, she said something like, I'm going to go to on the beach, and then Hogan says, can I come? And she says, no. And he looks all disappointed, and then she says, I'm only joking. And then she smiles, and he smiles, and off they go. A little banter between two lovebirds. Ain't it cute? So just imagine that. A Hulk Hogan, Pamela Anderson kind of thing coming together. Imagine he ditches Linda, you know, in the 90s. He gets with Pammy. Pammy and Tommy Lee never happened. The sex tape never happens. And next thing we see Pamela Anderson as the WCW World Champion in 99.
It could have been Hogan. It could have been Hogan and Pam doing the sex tape. I mean, they're both sex tape stars now, so they could have been. Maybe they could have been the originals, you know?
Yeah, I think so. That was the first scene, and I'm gonna have to gift the hell out of this. It's such an entertaining show, but
you know what? And beyond the gifts, anyone's listening, the whole episode is like 45 minutes on the playlist. It is worth your time. It is so friggin' ridiculous. It is so good. Go ahead.
So yeah, we then learn of a local boys' club that Hogan. You know, it used to be at, and it saved Hogan from a life of drugs and, you know, hanging around with gangs. He got fit and healthy, and, you know, that's what saved him. So they've got this kind of boys club, which just actually just looks like Muscle Beach, doesn't it? You know, Venice Beach, you know, where they all train outside.
Right.
You know, a boys club, it's all very odd. So he's got this boys club, but some of the lads train, and they come over and say, look, it's all well and good, Hogan, but look, it's getting closed down. What are we going to do? So, you know, the owner of the boys club says, yeah, it's true. They've got this developer who's taken over it. And next thing we see is a limo pulling up, isn't it, JT? And who steps out the limo?
Woo! Oh, this was my favorite scene of the whole thing. So Ric Flair, Kevin Sullivan, and Vader come out. Flair and Sullivan are in suits, and Vader's like in a friggin' wife beater. So they get out of the limo. And I thought Flair was like, the gravitas for him is amazing. To me, like, you look at Hogan's stilted acting, and he's supposed to be the big movie star, and Flair just comes out and is just himself and steals the whole scene. It feels so natural, talking about, you know, taking down the club, and he's the developer, and he challenges Hogan, you know, all the stuff, and he was fantastic. Like, I mean, if I'm watching that, I think he's the star. And I had everyone into that. I thought even Sullivan was better than Hogan, but Flair was like, just dominated the screen. Then Vader, to prove, so what happens is, obviously, Flair's buying over the boys club, and he's going to turn it into a hotel or whatever. And so Hogan wants to save the club, and they basically set up a match, which gets a little confusing. Because first Hogan challenges Flair and says he'll put the WCW title on the line. And then Flair says, no, let's make it a tag where him and Vader, because he wants his hands on Savage. But then, unless I missed it, for some reason it becomes two singles matches, obviously, because that's what Bash of the Beach was. It was Savage versus Flair and Hogan versus Vader. So I feel like they don't really ever agree on the fact that it's going to be two separate matches. It seemed like they were going to do a tag match. So then Vader, to show how awesome he is, grabs a basketball from one of the children and just pops it with his hands, just mashes it with his bare hands. And to me, this was the highlight of the whole episode. Like, this scene was tremendous. I thought Flair was awesome. And they get some good lines, some good jabs, because, you know, Flair, I guess, in theory, they call him retired or whatever at this point. And I thought that was all really done, even though Hogan just comes off like a dope. And I do like how realistic they made it seem with, like, you know, the Baywatch people, like, oh my God, Vader's a monster. How are you going to survive? You're never going to be able to take on Vader. You know, like, all that kind of stuff. And so I thought this scene was actually really good, and it mainly had to do with how awesome Ric Flair was.
Well, that, and the other thing I want to comment about this scene is, why was Kevin Sullivan there? And, you know, really, in storyline, yeah, he had some loose association, the Dungeon and Doom and the Horseman, but there's no association really with Vader. And the other thing, he was wearing a suit as well, but he was also wearing his Taskmaster giant eyebrows. thing. What was it? You know, what was he supposed to be? Was, you know, if you see that man walking down the street in a nice, you know, nice sharp suit and that face paint, you just laugh at the man. It wasn't scary and intimidating, especially when he's rubbing his hands with glee, you know, really in an animated cartoon fashion. It seemed to be believed, guys. You really, really need to check this out. It's classic WCW, this, and I loved every minute of it. So the next thing after...
I don't think... Did he even call him Kevin Sullivan? I think he just calls him Taskmaster the whole time, which is even weirder. Like, if some guy showed up on a beach as developer and he has a little midget guy with him in a suit and face paint called the Taskmaster, what would you, like, think about it? You know what I mean? Like, it's so random. Like, he's not even... They don't even call him Kevin. He doesn't even get his real name.
No, it was totally bizarre, his kind of involvement in this, but yeah, there he is, the Taskmaster. We then get to a training montage of Hulk, Pam, and some kids running down the beach with some kids doing backflips, which I did as a gift to tease this show the other day for you guys. And yeah, that's something else. Hogan's American-made theme song, which was his was this his first WCW theme? I think it was, wasn't it? It was.
It's just his only
stock.
Yeah, it's his only non. I think it's his only non-NWO theme that he had. I mean, he had the NWO theme song, then he had Voodoo Child. But I think this was his only, it was the only song he ever used. It was Jimmy Hart composed. And I always remember laughing at the time, like when I first heard it in 94, because it seems like such a blatant ripoff of Real American, just like the lyrics are backwards, you know what I mean? Like, if you listen to the two songs back to back, like they're very, very similar. It's just kind of, it's like when someone like plagiarizes an article, but just changes like four or five words around just to make it like it was their own. Like, that's what it sounds like to me.
Oh yeah, it's definitely a second-rate thing, but that's that was WCW just basically trying to be the WWF at many points throughout their history. So then we had the training montage, and then that led to the main event, didn't it? And it was in a Slim Jim cage. So it was sponsored by Slim Jim. So we had a bit of Slim Jim tie-in there, and we had Pamela Anderson there and other kind of kids and all kind of waiting for the match. And then they have the match, don't they? But it's filmed in a cinematic way, isn't it? It's not filmed. They haven't just taken the footage from the Bash at the Beach 95 show.
No, I like the pre-match interviews are funny too, because it's almost like it's like a local news broadcast. And like the owner of the kids club is the one interviewing Hogan. And then they have a random lifeguard interview Savage. Like the whole thing is so random and weird. He's like, what are you going to do, Macho Man? He's like, oh yeah. You know? And so then they go out and they have the matches, and yes, you're right. It's the Bash of the Beach matches, but they obviously filmed it with the Baywatch cameras. Because even at one point, they have the Baywatch lifeguards come out like behind Hogan or in front of Hogan, however they did it. And then so Savage beats Flair, and then we get the cage match between Hogan and Vader. Hogan beats Vader, and then they celebrate in the back. And I love when they come to the back, and Flair is just standing there with the deed in his hand. Like, if you're, I mean, this is the only way they can actually get this property from you. Like, I don't know if they drew up contracts on this thing or what, but he's just standing there with a rolled up paper in his hand, and Hogan just comes in and rips it out of his hand. We got the deed now, brother! You know, it's like so fucking stupid. And so then they're all celebrating, and like Flair gets, and Vader and Sullivan get overwhelmed by like all the fans and kids coming into the tent, and they all celebrate, and then they run onto the beach with the title and the deed, Hogan and Savage victorious.
Well, that's not. I wouldn't say that's a tent. That's the WCW gorilla position.
Yes,
you say,
true.
The curtain. So. Yeah. So why are they letting fans back there? God damn it, WCW. Have some restraint.
They celebrate the kids. You know, the children's club was saved. Boys and girls club, whatever the hell it is in this one.
Yeah, I mean, Hogan saved the rear ends of the children throughout the land. So thank you very much for that, Hogan. So they could eat their vitamins and train and do whatever Hulkamaniacs did in the mid 90s. So yeah, that was definitely a memorable episode. No, definitely something everyone should check out.
Well, we're not done yet, because I do want to mention the B storyline that was going on throughout this thing. And that is Lieutenant Stephanie, one of the Baywatch leads, of course, has her own issues going on. The acting in this part was almost, you know, I would say possibly worse than the main part. And Stephanie Holden, one of the main characters, discovers that she has skin cancer from obviously not wearing proper sunblock. And this is like super over dramatized. And then they have this weird scene that's like right out of Skinamax, where she's on a blanket with one of the other dudes, and he's like rubbing her. You know, he's like, "Oh, you have beautiful legs." You know, they're like kind of hugging, like they're gonna have simulated sex, but they're not. It's the whole thing is really weird. And then she finds out she's got the skin cancer, and she loses her mind, and she's going around to random people on the beach and yelling at them about not wearing enough sunscreen and telling them they have to apply better. And you know, like literally, like it's a whole scene of her going up to like 10 different people yelling at them on the beach about not wearing sunscreen. And then the last scene, if you haven't watched it, Alan, you need to watch it. The last scene to me is the highlight of the whole episode. So Hasselhoff and Stephanie are standing out on on this rock, like overlooking the ocean, just up there. And like the whole thing is very dramatic. It's very, very like they got this really dramatic music playing and they're waiting for the doctor to come in and tell them if the cancer has spread because they took additional testing. And so her and Hasselhoff are standing there kind of arm in arm. And the doctor with his little mullet and suit comes out and he's like, he's just standing there. And then Hasselhoff looks at him. Has it spread? And the doctor just looks back. Yes. like it's so ridiculous. Like, who the fuck does this? If you're finding out if your cancer has spread, are you having the doctor find you out on the beach and telling you, like, it's so stupid. Like, go to the office, you know? So then, like, she just breaks down. And then the doctor comes over and they all kind of hug. And they're like, well, you know, we'll figure this out kind of thing. And then the episode ends. But that one scene, it like made this whole thing. It's so ridiculous, that scene. The doctor's yes is one of the greatest like cinematic moments in history. It's so absurd. He says, has it spread? Yes. Like, so stupid. And that's the formal end of the episode. So they obviously were continuing that storyline on, and the Hogan stuff was just kind of there. But I'll tell you this, and I hope we actually tackle Thunder in Paradise at some point too, because this, you know, as a Thunder in Paradise fan like I was, this felt a lot like Thunder in Paradise. Like, it was very similar storylines, very similar, you know, the way Hogan was presented.
The whole thing, the whole presentation, is the way it was shot, I always coin it as a trash American TV over here that showed on a Saturday afternoon or Saturday evening, and that was things like Thunder in Paradise, that was things like Baywatch. Don't get me wrong, Baywatch was a huge, huge show. The memories for me, they always had Baywatch on a little bit after, maybe an hour or so after WCW Worldwide. It aired here in our region of the UK in the northwest of England, so there's a bit of a tie-in there over the years. But yeah, do you think that Hasselhoff didn't want anything to do with Hogan, so he was doing his own individual story? Because the two didn't cross paths at all in this episode, did they?
No, I wonder if it was like a filming thing, like a schedule thing, because they're all kind of separated. Like, Hoff is with Stephanie, and they never even really crossed paths with the Hogan stuff at all. So I almost feel like they just grabbed whoever was around, like the Bash of the Beach time, and just like banged out a bunch of scenes. Like, I don't know. It seems like they didn't actually go to the set or something like that. It seemed very separated, the whole thing. It was like two completely different storylines.
Yeah, definitely agree. But yeah, as I've said throughout this, check it out, guys. It's well worth 45 minutes of your time. So hopefully we've answered that question enough for Mental Mike. And hopefully Mental Mike, if he watches it, you know, the actual Baywatch show, because it's out there now and he was a bit vague about it, hopefully he doesn't get more mental by watching it.
Oh, Ric Flair. So you're the developer. I thought you'd be in a pond hiding under the scum where you'd feel at home.
Oh, Hogan, it's wonderful as always to see you again. And Macho Man,
last time I saw your face, man, it was under my shoe.
What are you doing with your time now that you're a washed-up ex-wrestler, Flair?
You know what they say, brother. Those who can do. Those who can't, don't.
Well, if that's the case, you'll appreciate this. For starters, man, I bought the property. You got it? In a week, it'll all be mine. But today, I'm here because I'm closing the gym down, big boy.
You can't do that.
Oh, little lady, that's where you're wrong. I'm the nature boy. I've got the documents. Soon, they'll all be condos. It'll all be mine.
Why don't you put your money where your sorry excuse for a mouth is, Flair?
Hey, Hogan, as usual, your words hit harder than your fist, man.
A fight. One-on-one, no holds barred. Winner take all. All this property, Flair.
Oh, man, doesn't that sound delightful? What's a collateral, Hogan?
Something that you could never hang on to, Flair. The WCW heavyweight title, brother.
Wait a minute, I call the shots. We're making a team. Me and Vader and Macho Man, I want you right here, right now.
I'd love to tear you apart.
Hey, a team wins both matches or all bets are off.
I hope so.
So, yeah, I hope so too. But I think that wraps up the show this week. I've had fun, especially with that Baywatch question. I had a hoot watching the kind of some clips from that. It was definitely a trip down memory lane. So shall I do the plugs, JT?
Yes.
Right, let's plug away. So check us out. You can follow us on Twitter. The first way is at Alan_Cheapshot. That's @AAAN_Cheapshot. And you can follow JT at @place2BNation. That's BE Nation. So you can check us out on there. Follow us. All sorts of cool stuff posted by us both throughout the day. You can send questions in that way. The other way you can send questions into the show is lettersfromcenterstage@gmail.com. We've had quite a few coming in now that way, which has been really great to see. And I'll always thank anyone who goes out the way to to send us questions, so you can send us questions in that way as well. Be greatly appreciated. Place to Be Nation, do you want to do some plugs for there, JT?
Yeah, facebook.com/placetobenation. You can follow us on social media there as well. We have our question of the day has been pretty popular over the last few weeks, so be sure to jump in the conversation. And you can also see each and every piece and article and audio that goes up on the website. We have, of course, our reaction show is up this week from the Payback pay-per-view and all kinds of different stuff. Scott Criscolo and myself with the Place to Be podcast, main event, clotheslines, and headlines. It's all out there for you each and every week. Recommend all of it. Be sure to check them all out, both on all of our feeds with the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, the Place to Be Nation pop feed, and the pro wrestling only feed, all available to you on iTunes. Rate us, like us, follow us today, and of course, shop with us, placetobenation.com/Amazon. So why don't we go to wrap things up, Alan? We'll be back next Friday with an all-new episode of Letters from Kayfabe. And listen to me. Letters from Center Stage. I get excited for a second. But we will, of course, also want to tease Alan. We have a big name in the works for a special guest, hopefully in the next month or so. I think he fits right in with the theme of the show. Do you agree?
Oh, yeah, it's a nice guest we've got lined up. Fingers crossed that will come to fruition. I'm very excited to speak to the man. He's been involved in a few different storylines and had one of the best, worst themes in WCW history.
He sure did. He sure did. So there we go. So for Alan, I'm JT. We're out. We'll talk to you next week right here, next Friday on Letters from Center Stage.
Adios.
Is it spread?
Yes.